Well, thank you both very much. We're pleased to see you again.
Yes. Always happy to come.
Always.
And I was pleased to have your good friend here the other day.
Jan Martel.
Jan Martel.
Yeah. What an experience.
Very nice visit.
He seems to be a nice fellow.
Yes.
He's an amazing man, yeah.
So did you get a good turnout for his reading?
Yes.
All the events, fabulous.
Very good.
Really wonderful.
Very good. Well, it's great. That's one of the things that doing this program is great for me, that I get a chance to meet and talk with people like that.
Yeah.
And actually, you know,
enjoyed it very much.
Last week when the nominees for the National Book Award were announced, I was pleased to look at the list and realize that four of them have been on this program. And one more, Celeste had her good friend T.C. Boyle talking about Drop City on in the afternoon. So I think between us, we've had five of the nominees
and
this year.
I don't know if you remember, but about 10 years ago, you interviewed J.M. Coetzee.
The winner of the Nobel Prize.
Yes.
I have reason to remember that interview because it was one of the most difficult I ever did.
I remember. In fact, I was in the room when he was being interviewed because he was afraid to go in alone with you. Do you remember that?
See, he seems to be a very nice guy, and he's a fine writer. But that's it. And I certainly know over time I've talked with writers who were magnificent writers, but who found it very difficult to talk about their writing.
Yeah.
And I'm either because they were shy or, you know, I think that there are some people who feel that they've said what they have to say and it's
book.
On the page.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And to go beyond that, they find it very difficult. And I know that he wasn't being difficult intentionally.
Oh, no, that's just the way he is.
The way he is.
Yeah, very shy man.
Yeah. So, yes, indeed, that Nobel Prize winner. And also we had on the winner of the Pulitzer for nonfiction. It was a book about genocide and the U.S. Response or lack of response to genocide over the last century.
Mm-hmm.
She was also on the program. So, we're doing
you would
pretty
say
well.
Focus 580 is an essential stop on the road to success?
On the road to success.
I would be much, much too modest to say anything like that. No. At any rate, I'll tell you what. We have a caller, and I don't
already?
Know. Why don't we start with a caller,
let's
and then
to that.
Because we'll have plenty of time
mm-hmm,
together.
Sure.
We'll give you a chance to talk about some of the books that you have brought. So, first person up here is in Downs, which is our toll-free line four. Hello.
Hello. I always look forward to this program, this particular one with the two of you, because
thank you.
Lots of wonderful ideas for books. Life of Pi has gone through all of our family, and then it goes on to friends, and then it comes back to the family. I would like to recommend a book which at least one of you is very intimate with. Mm. It's an older book. It's called How to Read an Unwritten Language.
Oh.
By Philip Graham.
I second the recommendation.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, I'll jump in, too, because I've read it, and I think it is a very fine book.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
I thoroughly, thoroughly enjoyed it. So I would recommend it to anyone who is looking for a good read or a good gift.
Yeah, could you say that louder, please?
By Philip Graham.
No, it's okay. It's just a joke.
And if you're interested in more things by Philip Graham, he just had a wonderful story published in Gargoyle magazine.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Okay.
It's fabulous.
We will look for that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Bye.
Is there another caller?
No. No, there are no more callers at the moment. What we'll do, I will turn to one of you and say, I know that each of you has a stack of books in front of you, and tell us about what you brought. I guess we'll start with Tanya.
Okay. I've been telling everyone to read this. It's called She's Not There, A Life in Two Genders by Jennifer Finney Boylan. And as you both know, as a lot of people know, I really have a great interest in gender identity and books about that. This is it's a memoir, and it's probably one of the most powerful books on the subject I've read.
Yeah.
She is, James Finney Boylan, before she made her transition, she was James Finney Boylan, and she taught and still teaches at Colby College in Maine with Richard Russo, and in fact, who was a writer I greatly respect. And he actually wrote the afterword to this particular book. And his new book of stories is dedicated to her, I believe, also. So they're very good friends. And he's a great writer. She's a great writer. She had some other books published as James Finney Boylan, some novels that didn't do really well, but I've read one of them. And she's just so clever. it's about her transition and about how she always felt like a girl as a child growing up. She always felt she had the spirit of a woman. She never really understood it, and she thought it was just part of adolescence.
Mm-hmm.
So growing up as a boy, she kept waiting for, she said she kept waiting for love to save her.
Mm.
Because she knew that when she fell in love, that everything would fall into place, and she would feel like a man, and she would feel the way she was supposed to feel, and that everyone thought she was supposed to feel. She says this, though. She meets her wife, Grace Finney Boylan. They took each other's names, which I think is really nice. Mm-hmm. She was Grace Finney, and he was James Boylan, and they both took Finney Boylan. Right after he met her, he fell in love with her almost immediately. And right after he met her, he says this. Wearing my sister's and mother's clothes wasn't exactly satisfying, though. For one thing, it was creepy, sneaking around. Even I knew it was creepy. For another, the thing that I felt wasn't satisfied by clothes. Dressing up was a start. It enabled me to use the only external cues I had to mirror how I felt inside. Yet it was the thing inside I wanted to express. I was filled with a yearning that could not be quelled by rayon. The book is... She is so funny through this entire book. She looks at the whole thing with really a great sense of humor, which I think is rare in this sort of situation. And it helps people be comfortable with it.
Yeah.
And it helps all of her colleagues be comfortable with it.
A yearning that could
not be quelled by rayon. That's right.
That should be on a monument somewhere.
It's not about clothing. It's not about clothing. It's about spirit. So after he meets his wife, he says, I went to the closet with an enormous garbage bag. Into this I put my skirts, my hose, the blue knit top, some underwear, my makeup, some bobby pins, everything. Then I tied up the trash bag and walked out to the curb and left it there. We will never speak of this again, I thought. Here at last we shall leave all of this and move onward with this new life, finally, miraculously, healed. There I was, standing beneath the Baltimore sky, but as I stood there, I remembered waves crashing against a jetty in Surf City, a child praying to be transformed by love. I looked inside myself, searching for the woman I had always felt myself to be. But she's not there. Shh, she thinks it's classical.
Mm.
Later on, I'd like to read the passage where she eventually comes to terms with, she's been dealing with this all her life, she finally comes to terms with the fact that it just can't go on this way. Yeah. She's married, you know, they're married, they have two children, two wonderful children, and they're very much in love. He always says he's still very much in love with his wife. But he goes to get some therapy, and he finally realizes that this is just not going to work. Mm-hmm. This is not who I am. So I'd like to read the conversation that he has with his doctor. Listen, he said, you aren't doing anything. You are a transsexual. Amazingly, you have managed to carry this burden all these years. It is time for you to get help. You need to turn to the people you love to help you. You can't keep carrying this burden alone. I'd rather keep carrying it alone, I said, than cause all this grief to the people I love. Well, Dr. Strange said, that's your choice, I guess. Do you really think you can keep on the way you've been going? How much further do you think you can go? I can't go any further at all, I said to him. Then what you have to do is clear, he said. No, what I have to do is completely unclear, I said. Just because I can't go any further as a man doesn't mean I can just pick up and start on the road to being female. I don't know how to do that. I can't do that. Maybe Grace will help you, he said. Maybe Grace will want to suffocate me with a pillow. Jim, Dr. Strange said, do you really think that's what's going to happen? No, I said, probably not. Actually, she'll probably want to suffocate herself with a pillow. Jim, Grace is a social worker. These aren't new issues to her. I'll bet she has more of a sense of how this works than you think. She does love you, no matter what else is true. She's going to want you to be happy. You really do live on your own little planet, I said, don't you? Dr. Strange stood up and spread his arms. Have a hug, he said. That evening, just before sundown, Grace was in tears, her heart broken in two. The burden that had been mine alone for all these years was now Grace's, and in the weeks that followed, she walked through her days broken and crushed. I had spent most of my life hearing the refrain of our culture, which says that truth is always better than lies, that we shouldn't have secrets, that the truth will set us free. Now that I had told the truth, I felt anything but free. Every time I looked at my family, I thought, remind me again what's so terrible about mendacity. Of course, our lives continued. In spite of the atom bomb that had gone off in our midst, Luke continued to board the bus for first grade each day, and Patrick was taken over to daycare several mornings a week. We would all get home at the end of the day, and the boys would eat macaroni and cheese and get their baths, and Grace or I would make dinner, and we'd sit down and eat it while the children watched Rugrats on television. I made salmon on the grill, marinated in jerk sauce. Actually, jerk sauce began to feel like the house brand. "So how are you doing?" The children were watching television in the sunroom. "Oh, I'm terrific," Grace said. She drank her Chardonnay. "Never better. Have you been thinking any more about, you know, the issues?" Something in the next room broke into hundreds of pieces. "What was that?" Grace shouted. "Nothing," Luke and Patrick said in unison. "I mean," I continued, "I'm trying to think about the issues." Grace's eyes filled with tears. "Jim, what do you want me to say?" "I don't know," I said. "I just want to know if you're like..." "Stop it," said Luke. "Mommy, Patrick's annoying me." "Luke," I shouted. "Patrick, if you can't play nice together, I'm going to have to separate you." Grace looked down at her salmon. "I feel like you're on a runaway train," she said. "What do you mean?" "I mean, you see this Dr. Strange, this maniac, for like 6 weeks, and all of a sudden it's like, that's it, you're going to..." "Luke," Patrick said angrily, "I'm warning you, don't make me bite you." "There's no biting," I shouted. See how they have this regular family going on amidst all this? "I'm not on a runaway train," I said. "I've been thinking about this stuff for years, for decades. I've tried negotiating with it every way I can think of. I have to do something now or I'm going to go crazy." "Well, I haven't been thinking about it for decades. I've been thinking about it for what seems like 5 minutes." "Ow!" Luke yelled. He came running to the table. "Daddy, Patrick bit me." "I'm sorry, Luke, but did you do anything to make him bite you?" "He said he was going to bite you," Grace said. "He was annoying me." Patrick came into the room. "Patty," Grace said, "we don't bite people in our family." She looked at me. "No matter how much we want to." "That's right," I said. "That's not how we express ourselves, not if we can help it." "I want a cheese stick," said Patrick. "Okay," Grace said. "I'll get it," I said, and went to the refrigerator. Grace finished her wine. Luke went back into the sunroom. Patrick grabbed the cheese stick as if it were the Olympic torch and ran as fast as he could toward the television. "What do you think we should do, Grace?" I said. "We?" she said. "What do you mean, we?" I want to include you in this," I said. "I want for this to be something that we do together." "Together? How is it going to be something we do together?" "I don't know, by sharing what we're going through, or..." Grace didn't say anything. "Can I get you anything?" I said, "while I'm up." Grace wiped her eyes. "I want what I had," she said.
Mm. Wow.
So, through all of that, she remains in love with her husband, or who she thinks of as her husband. She goes through the transition with him. He's never been happier in his entire life. He finally feels complete. They're still married to this day, and they're trying to... That doesn't mean everything's perfect, but they're trying to work it out for the sake of their children and their family. And she's there are comments in here about how she thinks that, you know, they're like sisters now. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't really matter. They're just a family. And at this point, he's not even attracted to men. He's simply a woman. Mm-hmm. And I've never seen... Have you seen the picture?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, she's beautiful. I mean, this is a person who you can tell from the beginning when she was a man all the way through to the end when she's made her full transition, come out to everyone at Colby College, had the support of all of her friends. She was a woman from the beginning.
Yeah.
And you can read it in in her thoughts, you know. So, amazing.
All right. And the book is She's Not There.
A Life in Two Genders.
By Jennifer Finney Boylan, B-O-Y-L-A-N. And this is not a novel.
No.
This is a memoir.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And also, by the way, I'm sure that we will try to get all the information on the books that Tanya and Philip are going to talk about this morning, authors, title publishers and everything. And we'll have that on our website. And also, I'm sure that we can have it printed up. And if people don't have internet, they can drop us a line and we'll send them a copy of the list.
Great.
And again, let me introduce our guests, Philip Graham, Tanya Leotsakos. Tanya works at Pages for All Ages Bookstore, and Philip teaches at the U of I, teaches writing, is a writer himself, and every once in a while they're here and they talk about new books because they love reading and writing and writers, like we do on this show, and they bring in big bunches of new stuff to recommend, and as I said, I've gotten some good recommendations that way. I've read some of the books that they have talked about. Maybe you have too. That's why we do the show. And if you... You listening have a book to recommend, you can do that too. Well, Philip, what do you got?
Okay. Actually, before I start, I wanted to mention that Tanya's husband, Ted Sanders, and I'm going to brag here a little bit, someone who was my student in a writing workshop, has just had his first story accepted for publication in a very prestigious literary magazine, Georgia Review, that's coming out in the next issue. So,
thank you, Philip.
You're welcome. Okay.
In spite of everything, she married a writer. In spite of everything she knows.
Think she would have learned.
In spite of everything she knows, she married a writer.
I'm a writer groupie.
Now, this is... this is a remarkable book. It's by a writer named Gerard Woodward, G-E-R-A-R-D, and then Woodward. And so it's his first novel, August, though he's published, I think, two or three books of poetry. He's an English writer. He's a very interesting man. He's won, you know, this novel was shortlisted for the Whitbread First Novel Award in 2001. He's been shortlisted for lots of other prizes and won a number, including the Somerset Maugham Award and the Eric Gregory Award. And his job is at the University of Manchester. He changes the soda cans in the machines.
Wait, the writer or
the... Yes, the writer.
Huh.
That's what he does. And then he writes these award-winning books of poetry and fiction. And actually, when he got this, a very successful, someone said, well, wouldn't you rather be on the faculty at the University of Manchester? Are you kidding?
Too much aggravation.
That was basically his response. Now, I think this novel, August, is an extraordinary novel. And one of the reasons is, and I'm going to go back a little bit to something that's always bothered me about one of my favorite novels, Anna Karenina, is that it has the worst opening of any novel, I think.
I can't even think of the opening of that book.
Well,
I love that
paraphrasing here, but it's something like all happy families are happy in the same way, and all unhappy families are unhappy differently.
I remember.
And even when I was a little kid, I thought that was not true. It just didn't ring right to me. You know, I don't think anything can be the same, whatever, you know. And I've always felt that happy families are different in their own way. And yet, after reading this book, not only does it contradict Tolstoy without even bringing up the issue, it's my own observation, but it avoids the dichotomy of saying that there are such things as happy families and unhappy families. This is a book about a family that goes on vacation in August to Wales every year. And we see them do this, sometimes years are passed by, but from 1955 to 1970, and we see this family grow and develop. And this is a story about a family that is both happy and unhappy. They have periods of happiness, they have periods of crisis, they have periods where there's a mixture. And what you do is you see this family grow as an entity, and you see this family fall apart as an entity as the children get older and start to move away and so forth. And it is, in fact, the most sophisticated and wise book I've ever seen about family life, period. I mean, it just really doesn't give you a sentimental soppy, they love each other. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, it doesn't give you this, maybe equally sentimental, everything is terrible and isn't it horrible that they don't love each other anymore. Instead, it's much truer to human nature and to the function of families as a group of complicated and complex people moving through time. I just want to read one little paragraph, just to give you a sense of the prose of this guy. He's clearly a poet. And this is about the father of this family, before actually the family exists, who goes on bicycling trips throughout Wales with his friend named Leslie, who is the brother of the woman that Aldous will eventually marry. And this is after a long day of cycling. The early evening after a day's cycling was nearly always silent for Aldous and Leslie. Neither would feel much like talking. They were together, but alone for a while, as though each was pitching an invisible tent of personal space, hammering in unseen pegs of identity. This was because cycling blended them into a single person. A whole day of cycling, of trying to match each other's pace, freewheeling side by side, becoming mirrors of each other's movements, made them almost into a single cycling entity which, in the evening, had to be unglued back into two individual people. This is August by the poet and novelist Gerard Woodward. It, I think, is not available in the United States. You have to go to Amazon.com, UK, or whatever. Well worth the journey.
We will talk some more and give Philip and Tanya a chance to give us some more of their recommendations in a second. But here, what we'd like to do is take an opportunity to give you a book. We have a lot of books in our Focus 580 collection. We receive them all the time, and many of them, we end up making shows out of those, but not all. And they pile up, and what we want to do is find homes for them. And all we're asking, folks, is that you will become a friend, become a financial supporter of the station at the basic membership level or better, and we'll send you a book. Jack Brighton, occasional host on the show, former producer of the program, now our current web guy, is here in the studio with me. The original Jack of Dave and Crazy Dave and Jack's Big Book.
That's right. That's right. I'm still crazy.
After all these years.
And especially now, after working here.
That's right. And now we have to include Harriet and Travis, so I figured now it should be Dave and Jack and Harriet and Travis's Big Book giveaway.
Right. Well, it gets longer every year, I guess. I like your theme, Homes for Books. That's what we're doing on the show this morning. We are trying to find homes for books. You can help us out if you have a space on your shelf, anywhere, for a book in your home. All you have to do is give us a call. We're happy to, anybody who makes a pledge at the $40 basic membership level in support of WILL, in support of Focus 580, we'll send you a book. And all you have to do is ask for it. Fiction or nonfiction are the categories. The number to call to get that, 244-9455. We like to see those phone lines light up, and we like to give away some books. And we have with us, with the phone volunteers in this place we call the Pledge Central, Maeve Riley, who is our patterns editor. And I know she likes books, too.
Oh, yeah, I sure do. And I enjoy Philip and Tanya's show every time they come on. And we've got great volunteers standing by. Alan and Carol and Heather are standing by the phones, ready to take your call for the great book giveaway. And, you know, it's important that we hear from people today. We'd like to get to $80,000 by the end of the day today. And right now we're at $66,531, which is great. And we'd like to thank all the people that have already made a pledge. But if you haven't made a pledge yet, what better opportunity than now? Get a book if you make a pledge at $40 or above, and help support great public broadcasting.
Absolutely. We'd like to hear from 40 Focus 580 listeners this morning between 10 and noon. We'd like to get 40 pledges. If you've never pledged before, this is your chance to support the show, support the station, and also get one of these books. Now, these are grade A books, folks. These are not, you know, cheap little throwaway paperbacks. Okay?
No, we're talking about recently published books. They're hardcover. They're from reputable publishers, and they're good stuff. Truly, I don't want to
see a graph.
No, I don't want a single.
Oh, no staples.
I think we all know what that means. I think we all know the difference between reputable publisher and the rest.
All right, we do.
Okay,
we do.
You guys are in the business. You know perfectly well what we mean. So they're good books, and you can have your choice: fiction, nonfiction. We have a lot of things that have to do with politics, history, social political issues, but then we also do receive a number of novels, and those are again recently published novels in hardcover. So you might be among the first to read a particular book, and then you could pass that around. Maybe pass it around among your family members or your friends.
Absolutely,
put that writer's name and work out there. So that's the deal. But it's really important that we hear from as many people as possible, because over time, those folks who have been our loyal supporters over many years, we just can't rely on that same number of people to deal with this financial situation that we're moving into in the future. Right now, we're at half the money to run the station comes from listeners, and that's had to increase because the public money has had to decrease. So what we're really talking about is a different way of thinking about funding public broadcasting in this country. Moving away, more and more, moving away from that taxed-based funding and relying more and more on listeners. So if you listen to the station, and if you have never given us any money, now would be a great time to do it.
Absolutely. If you've never contributed before, please consider this. We know that only about 1 out of 10 listeners to the station actually supports the station with a pledge every year. 1 out of 10. Now, if we could just make that 2 out of 10, that would make a tremendous difference, and that would actually get us over this hump that we're experiencing right now with the declines in state, federal, university funding. So if you've never pledged before, this is a really good time to get on board. $40 basic membership pledge gets you Patterns Magazine. It's less than a dollar a week, if you think of it that way.
Sure.
And also gets you a free book. So all you have to do is call the pledge line, 217-244-9455, and just ask for either fiction or nonfiction book, Focus 580 approved, grade A, and we'll gladly welcome you to the Friends of WILL.
Now, those 9 people out there, they sound like they're the dark matter of the universe. You know they're out there, but they're not.
But you're not quite sure what.
Yeah,
you know.
Well, that's right. Most of the universe.
Come into the light, everyone. You know? Become a star. You know, become the nebula of some sort, so we can see you. Yeah.
Okay. One more time, we give you the number, and someone called in and suggested that when we give the number, we should give the area code. So we'll do that. It is in fact area code 217-244-9455. That's the number to call to make a pledge. And if you would rather, you certainly may pledge online. Go to our website, will.uiuc.edu. Okay, we'll talk some more with Maeve and Jack in a moment. We have a caller in Chicago. Why don't we talk with this person here on our toll-free line? Line 4, hello.
Yes, I have a series to recommend, and I'm recommending this with an ulterior motive. I am really hoping and praying one day that you will have the author, Donna Leon, on your show. She writes the mystery series, Commissario Guido Brunetti. And it's a fabulous series. I think for people who want to know what's happening in what Donald Rumsfeld called Old Europe, reading the series just gives you an incredible opening to what Europe is like today and what Italy is like today. And she just covers everything. It's a brilliantly written series. So I hope that somehow, maybe by telephone, you can have her on.
How do you spell her last name?
It's L-E-O-N.
Oh, okay.
And she's an American, but I think she's lived in Italy for at least 30 years because she seems to know the Venetian character. Well, I don't know. I used to, before I traveled, I always thought James Michener knew what was happening. Then when I went to the countries that he visited, I realized he had no clue. So it might be the same story with Donna Leon, but I don't think so. I just get the feeling that she has just lived there long enough and learned the character. And what I find amazing about her books is you see an Italy where things are functioning despite an incredible amount of corruption, and it makes you wonder if we're becoming Italy and how long a country can function that way. And I think if you could ever have her on the show, it would be wonderful.
Is this fiction?
It's fiction. It's a mystery series.
How many
series?
But
I'll give you an idea of her type of sensibility. One of the stories looks at the sex trade, and the commissario is investigating the death of these women who are being imported from various countries, and they're being fooled, and they come there thinking they're either going to get work or get married, and instead they're turned into the sex trade. Mm-hmm. And he's really upset about it, so he calls friends that he has in the countries where the women are coming from, one from the Philippines and another in Brazil. And when he calls them, he's full of outrage and upset, and when he speaks to the man in Brazil, this particular man had just been had to, I think, fire a couple of policemen who had been hired to murder street children by shopkeepers. And so he really didn't feel that Brunetti's outrage was that important. And when he called the guy in the Philippines, the guy in the Philippines said, well, you know, if they stay here, they'll die from AIDS. And I think that her ability to take a problem, whereas I think Americans, our culture, it would just be to go inside. Mm-hmm. Instead, she goes outside and says, put this in the world perspective of other people's lives. Mm-hmm. And to me, that was just the classic of how her book is written, that you become part of the whole world when you read it.
That sounds terrific. Mm.
Well, we'll see what we can do. It's sometimes difficult. It's tough enough to get authors who live in the United States, but if someone who lives overseas, that's even that much more difficult. But occasionally people like that do come to the United States to do a tour.
Yeah.
And this, apparently Penguin is the publisher of
she has books in print here. Yeah. Is that right?
Yes, she does. She's in print in several languages. She won a very high prestigious mystery award from Japan. I think she's basically more popular overseas than she is here. Hmm. I know her books have been translated into German, almost all of them. But I just discovered her, and I think that she's a wonderful writer. But as I said, I think the main thing is that it just opens the door to what was called Old Europe.
Hmm. Well, we'll see what we can do
and
see if that might be possible.
Okay.
We appreciate the suggestion.
Thanks very much.
We have another call here. Why don't we go on and we'll talk with this listener in Aurora. That's on our line one. Hello.
Yeah, hi. I wondered if it's possible not to have a new book, but to have an old book that I just finished reading and I'm telling the world about.
Sure. That, of course.
That probably everybody has read it but me. I just became involved with my granddaughter who's just started to teach and was having a lot of difficulty teaching in an underprivileged neighborhood. I called up the church to a nun at the church to see if who was a teacher, and could she help me help my granddaughter? And she told me to read the book The Water Is Wide by Pat Conroy.
You never read that book? Everybody's read that
Everybody
book.
Everybody has read that book.
Yes, I know. I was the last one.
No, actually, I haven't read that book.
I've read it.
Yeah.
Isn't it a wonderful book?
I do remember enjoying it. It was a long time ago.
I know. It was in 1970.
Is this the Prince of Tides guy?
Pat Conroy,
okay.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Could I just read briefly a paragraph?
Sure.
With children, he comes into this island. He wanted to go into the Peace Corps, but they didn't call him. He found out about this job, teaching underprivileged children, to say the least, at Yamacraw in South Carolina. And this is what it speaks to. With children almost totally ignorant of the world outside and practically illiterate, their minds dulled by rigid adherence to obsolete theories of education and harsh discipline, orthodox teaching methods were out of the question. The only hope lay in startling them out of their lethargy. And in this, Mr. Conroy was completely successful. Instead of handing out books, most of the children were incapable of reading. He loosened them up and dusted the cobwebs out of their little heads. In short order, they learned the names of the country and the state they lived in, the president of their country, of the ocean that washed the shore of their island, of the continent from which their ancestors had come, and many useful, interesting facts unknown to them. Above all, they began to believe that they were people with rights and special qualities of their own, and that it was possible to be friends with a teacher and to even laugh at him and with him. It is such a divine book. I feel very amiss in not having read it, but I'm glad I did at this late date. And, of course, I've told everybody else to read it also.
Great. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.
And,
we need more old books.
Sure.
The only thing I tell people, don't get it out now when you have any work to do. Get it in January when you can sit for 4 days straight.
Good advice. Yeah.
Bye-bye.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
And certainly other recommendations from people who are listening are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, we'll come back to our guys here in the studio, and I think next it would be Tanya's turn.
I can't wait to tell you about this book.
Mm-hmm.
It is another memoir. It's called, I don't know why I'm reading all this nonfiction all
it
of
happens,
a sudden.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm just having a stint of nonfiction. Sickened, the memoir of a Munchausen by proxy childhood. Do you know what Munchausen by proxy syndrome is?
I don't know. I've been looking at that for about 20 minutes and I've been wondering.
It's a disease where it's named after Baron von Munchausen, who, you know, was explorer of the 18th century and was famous for telling all of these ridiculous, outrageous stories. Munchausen by proxy is a disease where a parent, usually the mother for some reason, but it can be any parent, either makes a child sick or pretends that the child is sick in order to get attention.
Yeah.
Exactly. From family, from community, from medical professionals in particular. They sort of see doctors as gods and want attention, want attention for their... So this poor girl...
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, she's actually an amazing woman. Her name's Julie Gregory, and she has pretty much educated herself. She grew up in southern Ohio in a double-wide trailer, which they kept adding on to.
Mm-hmm.
They had a lot of animals. Very, very abusive household. The father was really physically abusive. And it was almost at the mother's encouragement that he was. You could see that the father, deep inside, was not a bad guy. He was trying, but the mother needed him to help her with this illusion of the child being sick. So she's grown up all her life. The mother goes from doctor to doctor to doctor to doctor, saying my child is tired. She has insomnia, mm-hmm, or she can't. She has a tickle in her throat. It starts with very, very small things, things that you know. And she always changes her appearance when she goes. She puts on her, you know, her doctor outfit. She puts on a suit and does her hair and does all these things. So she seems credible and she behaves as if she cares deeply about the child's welfare. And no medical professional, I mean, or anyone really, you know, when you see a parent concerned about the health of their child,
sure,
you would never suspect this.
Yeah.
There are 12,000 new reported cases of this.
12,000?
12,000 new reported cases of this in the United States every year. So I'm glad she wrote this to try and, you know how she learned to read? Her parents didn't take her to the library much. They didn't do much for it at all, actually.
Oh, no, I think I see what's coming. Mm-hmm. Oh, no.
What happened was she began to pick up books in doctor's offices.
Oh, God.
And she would steal the books from doctor's offices, sneak them home, and read. She said almost all of her collection, as a young child, pilfered from doctor's offices. It's the only access she had to books. So I'm going to read a couple of passages. This is very hard. It's very hard to get a handle on what in the world is going on in this kind of abuse. But this passage gives you an example of how, you know, it's undetectable. It's really undetectable sometimes. And families can seem perfectly happy when in reality there's a hell going on underneath. Our strange times are punctuated with brilliant ones, too, enough of them to convince me of the happy childhood mom and dad say I have, since kids in Africa are dropping off like flies. Times when all convention is thrown out the window and we say to hell with having turkey on Thanksgiving and cook up a bunch of shrimp instead, laughing at our quirky freedom. We are free of relatives, neighbors, friends. Nobody can tell us what to do. We'll stick a can of Crisco in the fondue pot and tempura up a pile of cheese cubes and mushrooms for Christmas dinner. Who says we have to follow any rules? Dad is a one-off inspirational chef. Most of his weekends are spent watching TV or tinkering in his garage, but now and then he wakes up early, has his Agent Orange puke, gets out the heavy pressure cooker pot and candy thermometer, and we make rock candy. We have to plot how we're going to get the flavors, because Mom thinks it's a waste of money. So when we're all in town, Dad and I sneak back to the pharmacy counter while Mom gets groceries, and we act like espionage spies, asking in a whisper if we can see the flavors in the back. The pharmacist plays along, looks around to see who's watching, and then covertly opens up a cabinet where hundreds of small vials of potent flavors sit: butterscotch, tutti frutti, strawberry, watermelon, whorehound. While Dad drains a whole bottle of Karo syrup into the pan, I pick out the flavors from our growing collection. The pot of hard candy is poured out onto wax sheets in a big production where Dad, in big fluffy mitts up to his elbows, at the exact set second and temperature, shrieks, "Look out, sissy, look out!" and zooms across the kitchen to ooze the concoction onto the paper before it starts to set. I fly out of Dad's way and sprinkle the cooling candy with powdered sugar. Then Dad and I take the big sheets and strike them against the edge of the counter to make smaller ones, and then I get to break them into mouth-sized pieces with our drywalling hammer. And the rest of our happy times were captured in Kodak moments as tangible proof for the world to see that we were, in every sense of the word, normal. tucked in Christmas cards and signed with our individual names, forged in Mom's own cursive handwriting. These photos, us standing on the edge of the painted desert, crowded into a plywood cutout shark's mouth at SeaWorld, grimacing next to our horses, holding runners-up ribbons, were the casting lines out to distant relatives and long-lost friends Mom so desperately wanted to look good to. But the real truth can be scrutinized by peering just a little closer at the small stack of pictures left over from the fire. The mother burned down the trailer eventually, by the way. In one Polaroid, me, Mom, and Danny sit amidst a frenzy of torn wrapping paper under the Christmas tree, loaded with ornaments, laden with icicles, and three of us surrounded by a moat of presents, Stretch Armstrong, ballerina jewelry box, Hot Wheels loop-de-loop racetrack, Rubik's Cube, Spirograph, Mousetrap, Latch Hook rug kit, box set of Black Beauty and other classics, all the proof of our happy Christmas. Danny wears his funny clown face. Mom cranes her neck, strains a smile, and hiding behind my own puffy eyes is the tiniest glint of what really happened that morning. Mom screeching through the trailer, threatening to commit suicide. That gives you an idea of, you know, you see these pictures, you hear these stories, you wouldn't see the family. It's totally undetectable. I want to read another quick passage. The mother, she does this in all kinds of very manipulative ways. One of the things she does when Julie is a little girl is she gives her matches to chew on.
Ooh.
And she calls them lollipops. Now, if you want to know something that will make you sick, you know, that will make you sick. She also feeds her things like cake batter for breakfast. So she does these things to make her at least have the appearance of being sick. I mean, you know, she's not healthy. She doesn't have good color. You know, she makes the daughter sick. How long can you starve without side effects? If everyone around you tells you you're sick, if they keep testing you for what's making you sick, do you think when you're 13 that you aren't? You feel sick, right? It's true what Mom says. You can't keep up. You are tired. Isn't there something wrong with you if you feel sick all the time? If you miss school by going to doctors and miss school by lying in the nurse's office half the day, is it the wrong medication that makes you sick, or the three different kinds you take all at once? My childhood wishes come true. I have turned paper thin and translucent, as if a strong wind could whisk me high into a blue fall sky like a brittle-veined maple leaf. Mom goes to parent-teacher conferences and meets with my teachers individually about my heart condition. I hear the story over and over. My stabs of chest pain, my shortness of breath, causing low oxygen to my brain, which explains why I'm doing poorly in school. I sit in the chair next to her, sucking air in through my hanging mouth. I just want to lie down and fade away. They are to keep an eye on me and send me home if I look faint. Teachers slice me a sideways glance as my sunken collarbone and accordion frame slink through the halls. Watch her, they're thinking. She could go any time. And so when you've been told you're sick all your life, you start to believe it, and you start to feel it. I know I've been talking for a long time, but I just want to read one more passage from a conversation with her cardiologist. The cardiologist tells the mother, look, there's nothing wrong with your daughter. And the mother loses her mind. Do you want to do that first?
You've taken us this far.
Okay.
We'll stay with you.
Okay. You know, what's really neat about this is that it's punctuated with all of these medical records. Her actual medical records are in here, and you can look and see, you know, that there's nothing wrong with her. We stand in the corridor of Ohio State Hospital, me, Mom, and my cardiologist. Sometimes teens are just tired and run down, he says. I don't have a heart murmur, he says, and he can't really do any more for me. Mom talks in soft confidence like a colleague. She leans in close, just like old times. She's considering the tests they've been through together and pondering the disappointing outcome of this one. Well, Michael, let's get a plan of attack together here. In the face of these inconclusive test results, now is the time that I think we really need to move in with the open-heart surgery and finally, once and for all, get to the bottom of this thing. He stares at her. Miss Gregory, Julie does not need heart surgery. I'm sure you're pleased to hear that. He clears his throat. There's nothing in these tests that leads me to believe that she would benefit from such an invasive procedure. I believe in time her heart condition will clarify and become more pronounced so as we can assess it, or she may just outgrow it on her own. At most, we could consider her a possible candidate for an early precondition of mitral valve prolapse. You're kidding me. No, I'm not. Julie is within normal range of our tests. I can't believe it. I cannot believe this. You're not going to dig into this and do the open heart? I thought we had agreed to follow this through to the end, Michael. I thought you said you were committed to me on this. I'm committed to finding Julie's illness, Miss Gregory. But Julie doesn't need heart surgery. Usually parents are thrilled to... Oh, that's just it. That's all you're going to do. Just drop me like a hot potato. I mean, for crying out loud, why can't I just have a normal kid like other mothers? I mean, I'm a good mom. 4-H, horses, swimming pool, camping trips. I do, and I do, and I do. You act like I'm doing something wrong. What did I do to deserve this? She thrusts an arm back to me. I'm standing behind my mother's left leg, my eyes glued to the doctor, boring an SOS into his eyes. Mm. Don't make me go. Don't let her take me. Miss Gregory, I didn't say you weren't a good mother, but I can't do anything else here. You need to drop the heart procedures, period. And with that, he turned on his heel. Well, you're the one who's going to be sorry, Mom screeches, when this kid dies on you, that's what, because you're going to get sued out the yin-yang for being such an incompetent idiot. Can't even find out what's wrong with a 13-year-old girl. You're insane. This kid is sick, you hear me? She's sick.
Yeah. And this is, the book is titled Sickened. By Julie Gregory. And this is Julie Gregory writing about her own
life.
Her own life, right. Her own childhood.
Correct.